Welcome to Brain Core, the podcast that introduces you to new psychology and neuroscience research. I'm Tolu Faramika, and I'm joined by my co-host, Christina Valkanis. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Tolu. How's it going?
Pretty good. Last month, we explored a specific therapeutic use of psychodrama in a case study with the author, Dr. Nikos Takis. These next 2 months, we are delving into the topic of consciousness, particularly from different perspectives. Today's perspective is a unique one, in my opinion. We are joined by the amazing Patricia Churchland, founder of Neurophilosophy. She has also introduced and strengthened certain arguments on the topics of morality, neuroethics, conscience, and our focus for today, consciousness. Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's lovely to be here.
That's great. So I know you mentioned to us that you're currently in BC.
Yes.
British Columbia for our non-Canadian listeners. So how are things there at the moment?
Well, we had a fabulous thunderstorm last night, but today is clear and sunny, so that's very nice. And the spring salmon are running, and that's good.
That's great to hear. It was also raining here in Toronto yesterday.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
So Christina and I finally had the chance to get together and plan a bit for future projects and also to share our excitement for this episode. And I was personally introduced to your work in my Theories of Mind class last semester, and it was quite interesting to me at the time. So listeners might expect that our term of the episode will be consciousness, but I think over the next few episodes, we might realize that consciousness may take different forms and is more of a conversation than it is a distinct definition. With that said, our term of the episode, or TOTE, is actually going to be neurophilosophy. So, Pat, how would you define neurophilosophy, and could you maybe give us a little background on how the idea came about?
Yes, well, I think of neurophilosophy as sort of at the interface of the grand old questions about the nature of the mind. How do we learn and understand? Why do we sleep? How do we make decisions? What is self-control? Between those kinds of questions that philosophers have considered, and developments in neuroscience, but not just in neuroscience, also in experimental psychology, anthropology, molecular biology, and so forth. And I think that the basic reason that neurophilosophy is coming into its own is really that the tools and techniques for studying nervous systems have changed so enormously over the last 50 years. That it's now possible to make real progress in understanding, for example, how it is that we learn and remember certain things. And really for me, and studying in the late 60s and early 70s, there were really two very dramatic discoveries that made me reconceive everything within philosophy, although I think I was also ripe for that reconsideration. But the first had to do with the patient HM, who, as you know, had intractable epilepsy, and he had surgery bilaterally to remove the medial temporal lobe. And that meant that it took the hippocampus as well as related hippocampal structures. Nobody at that time really had a clue what this little dinky piece of stuff in the middle of the brain actually did. But it turned out, as you know, that HM could remember things from his childhood or his adolescence, but he could no longer learn anything new. And Brenda Milner, who is at McGill and has been for many years a brilliant neuroscientist, realized the monumental importance of this discovery. In any case, what it meant was that there are certain kinds of memories that depend on the hippocampus, that memories that are stored for a long period of time do not depend anymore on the hippocampus, and also that HM could learn skills. He could learn to solve certain kinds of puzzles, but he was not able to remember that he had ever seen those puzzles before. This had a profound effect on me as a philosophy graduate student because I thought, here are all these guys trying to understand the nature of knowledge, of learning and memory. This is highly relevant, but by and large, the philosophers weren't interested. They thought, no. What we are doing is we are doing conceptual analysis so that neuroscientists can understand what they're talking about. Oh, dear. The second major and very dramatic discovery had to do with the split brain results, which, as you know, had to do with, again, modifying intractable epilepsy, and it involved cutting the corpus callosum. And as you know, the subjects who underwent split brain commissurotomies had essentially a split consciousness. And to me, it seemed kind of obvious. Look, if you can split consciousness by splitting the brain, then consciousness has to be related very intimately, almost certainly causally, to the brain itself. It can't be some spooky soul stuff. It has to be related in a very deep sense to the way the brain is put together. Now, of course, there were many other kinds of results that had an impact on how I thought about those two things, but I just want to highlight those two because they were both the beginning of a tremendous research program into understanding what philosophers called epistemology and the nature of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned those two cases because I had watched your lecture called To Understand the Mind, You Must Understand the Brain. And I think those cases highlight that idea as well. But for some of the listeners that aren't as familiar with this differentiation between the mind and the brain, would you be able to distinguish or compare these two terms or even describe why you think there's a separation between the terms?
Well, I think that there are certain functions of the brain that are very reflexive. So, for example, last night with the first clap of thunder, I had a startle reflex. And we know now quite a bit about the startle reflex. And on the other hand, I lay there in bed and I thought about certain things that I had just read, and I was reflecting on the history of ancient Rome, and we think of those as mental. Now, in the history of thought about these things, there are really two lines. One is typified by Plato and Descartes, and more recently, David Chalmers. And that is that consciousness cannot possibly be a physical thing. It has to be independent of anything physical. It might ride parallel to physical events, but it can't itself be physical. On the other hand, we see in ancient Greece, the great physiologist or physician Hippocrates took a very different view. And throughout the history of philosophy, there have been others who took the view that we may not yet understand how many things work, including how the brain works. But almost certainly there is a deep relationship between mental functions, including consciousness in the brain itself. And that was actually the view of Aristotle. Now, of course, Plato was much more sexy and dramatic than Aristotle, who's a bit more like your dad. And so when you're an undergraduate, you really kind of find Plato exciting and interesting, and Aristotle, well, not so much. But as time has gone on and as science has proceeded, it increasingly seems likely that the brain is the repository of memories, of decision-making, of self-control, and so forth. Now, for the dualists like Chalmers, he has a problem of explaining, and this is so-called mind-brain problem. He has a problem of explaining how soul stuff and brain stuff interact. For Hippocrates and Aristotle and I, we don't have a mind-brain problem because we don't think there's two things. We think that there is just this very complicated function, many, many functions, most of which we don't have a very deep understanding of yet. But there isn't a mind-brain problem because there are two distinct substances that need to interact. The other problem that basically dualists have is they need to explain how soul stuff does things. How does it learn and remember? How does it have self-control? How is it that we see in color? If you're a soul stuff person, you've got to explain that. And there is no science of soul stuff, not even a shred of a science of soul stuff. Descartes thought that there could be. And other scientists have tried to make that happen. But so far, it seems that, you know, you kind of look and, you know, so like, where's the progress here, folks? And there isn't any. So that's the basic background to the sort of physicalist approach and the dualist approach. And I don't think we can say for certainty at this time what is likely to develop in neuroscience, in the set of neurosciences in the next 100 years or so. But if you have to bet real money, or in your case, real time, where are you going to invest? That's the question. And I came off a farm. So I wanted to invest in something that was actually going to be productive. And I couldn't see that philosophy was going to be productive. I can't see that dualism is going to be productive.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of, just like you say, you kind of need neuroscience to help you understand the mind either way. And it's necessary, but I know I read you wrote, it's necessary to understand the mind, but not sufficient. And I like that because it leaves rooms for other disciplines to provide answers. Absolutely. And ideas. Yeah, and sometimes I do find that science is a little quick to, like, reduce things to the simplest explanation or say, like, this is the answer and close off. But I think that that's a great, great idea to leave room for other people and other disciplines to bring in ideas.
Yeah, and without a doubt, because I mean, one of the things that is so remarkable about the mammalian brain, and that includes not just us, but mice and rats and the whole bit, is that we're born so immature and our brains build structure as they learn. And that means that if you kind of want to understand some of what is learned and how it's organized in the brain, you have to pay attention to the environment that allowed for the learning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a great point. I want to say one thing that is quite interesting is that, like, when we look at history, the history of psychology, a lot of concepts and ideas originated from philosophers, right? Philosophers like Aristotle, Descartes, Plato, like you mentioned. And Mark Twain once said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I'm sensing a bit of a rhyme here because it seems like the idea of neurophilosophy is that we have progressed to a point where neuroscience and psychology can now influence and inform the philosophical questions that we're asking, right? As opposed to how things were at the start when philosophy informed psychology. But do you think we might ever return to that again if philosophy were to take into consideration what is happening in neuroscience and in the brain?
I think that with regard to sort of cognitive functions and motor control and sleep and dreaming and so forth, that there is a real place for theory. I mean, there's a real place for experiments because without data, you know, you're just another person with an opinion. So there have to be data. On the other hand, data collection is incredibly time consuming. And if what you want to do is theorize, then that kind of means you have to spread yourself across many fields: molecular biology, anthropology, genetics, neuroscience. And to do that, you probably can't be spending long, long, long hours in the lab. So I think what some neuroscientists do and what some philosophers are now doing is being part of a laboratory setting, but also asking the slightly broader questions. And I think that's a really important function. But to sort of go more directly to your question, you have to ask yourself, well, what is it? What is the technique that philosophers use? What's the, you know, like, how might they help? And Dan Dennett's answer is that they help because they take a concept and they clarify it. And then the scientists can use that concept to study. And I think that's just self-serving nonsense. I don't think you can point to a single example in the history of science, whether it's atom or temperature or where the philosophers analyzed the concept. And then the science did its work. I mean, when you think about temperature in a gas, for example, I mean, was it that the philosophers analyzed the concept of caloric fluid? And then Lord Rutherford tested them? No, he didn't need that. He went ahead and tested it, and he found that the better explanation was not in terms of a fluid that passed from hot things to cold things, but rather in terms of mean molecular kinetic energy. So, I mean, I think it's important to remind ourselves that it's good to be clear. Although sometimes people ask for clarity where clarity is not yet available.
Right.
And if it's not yet available, we think, well, you know, maybe I'll know next year.
That's true.
But I think if philosophers, and I was sold on this idea when I was a graduate student, you know, clarify concepts. And it didn't make much sense to me at the time. And I had a number of friends who were graduate students in Pittsburgh with me, and we used to laugh about this a lot. And so I sort of came away with the idea that speculation is great, theorizing is great, not in a vacuum, not without humility, but then the speculation and the theory have to be tested. Mm-hmm. And philosophers used to think, but I don't think this is quite so true now, that they didn't need to test anything because they could use arguments. And I think, oh yeah, arguments are dandy, but without data, where are you?
Right. We go back to just them being opinions, basically.
That's kind of my worry. And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm really dissing philosophy because I think, but I am actually, but during my period as a graduate student, there were not very many philosophers who were all that interested in the sciences, but there certainly were some. Mm-hmm. And Chris Elias Smith, who's, I guess, thought of as a philosopher, engineer, technician, wunderkind, and Waterloo, he was an example of somebody who really did take it seriously. And he had such a capacity for thinking broadly. He could pull in all kinds of stuff and all kinds of data, all kinds of conceptions, and make real progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll turn away a little bit. Do you think that there is room? I know we've already kind of talked about the soul, and you said you don't really see that the idea of a soul could really exist in neurophilosophy. Mm-hmm. But I feel like on the surface, it may seem like perhaps there isn't room. because what previously we would have attributed to our souls or spirit can now be attributed to biological mechanisms and brain processes. However, is it possible that neurophilosophy can give a different definition to the concept of a soul? Like, could it be that the soul is a culmination of these physical processes and mechanisms? Or would that idea contradict the neurophilosophical perspective?
That's a really interesting question, actually. And my tendency is to think that most people associate the idea of a soul with something non-physical that survives the bodily death. So it would be sort of like saying, you know, yes, we understand about the helical structure of DNA. We understand how mRNA works and transfer RNA. We understand the ribosome. We understand mitochondria. Couldn't we just say that vital spirit is all of that? Mm-hmm. And I mean, oh, geez, you know, that's not what vitalists had in mind. And I actually had a vitalist biology teacher in high school. And no, they think of it as a completely non-physical thing. And it's the only thing that can explain how you get livingness itself out of dead molecules. Except that now we know we have a better explanation of how structure, physical structure, can come together in such a way as to constitute a living thing. But consider the complexity in that story. So it's possible that, you know, there is soul stuff, but every day we discover something even more remarkable about the nature of the brain. You know, Google has this absolutely massive database now of neurons. And you have a look. I mean, I can't get much on my computer because it's just a laptop. But you look at these pictures of the complexity of neurons and you think about the complexity of the physiology of each of these things. Mm-hmm. And you think, how could you be very confident in saying, you know, this is Chalmers, you'll never be able to explain the subjective feelings in terms of neurons. How could you know that?
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. Like if you zoom out from the neuron level and we get to thinking about things like consciousness, morality, even conscientiousness or empathy as well, it's something that's hard to define emotionally and then to think of how the neurons would explain that. I just want to throw animals into the mix too, because I'm an animal lover and I grew up surrounded by animals. And from my interactions with them, it's kind of hard for me to think of them just as systems of biochemical reactions and nothing more. Like anyone who has a pet thinks of them as something with conscience or some sort of conscientiousness. But I think a lot of it also depends on how we define these things and how we relate them to the brain. Even, again, like you were saying about the soul, how somebody defines the soul. Is it something religious? And then how would they relate that to the brain? So I guess one thing that we can look into a little bit more easily is these concepts of morality. And I know that social influences affect how we interact on a neurological level and then absolutely on a social level. So I guess what I wanted to ask is, if we look at these things like morality and conscience deriving from our drive to be social as human beings, what about other animals? Like, is there this same impact in animals?
There is no doubt that all mammals are social to some degree. Mm-hmm. Some are highly social, like us and rats and monkeys and beavers. Mm-hmm. Beavers mate for life. Who knew, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. I recently learned that. Well, isn't that cute? Aww. But yes, they're highly social. And we now know quite a bit, but by no means everything there is to know about the mechanisms that regulate sociality and how if those mechanisms are disturbed, you get very different kinds of behavior. And we know, of course, as I'm sure you know too, that oxytocin and vasopressin are crucial parts of the story. Mm-hmm. That other crucial parts of the story have to do with how oxytocin and vasopressin help one animal to bond to another, in particular, how the mother bonds to the babies, and in turn, the baby bonds to the mother. And we know that it's very pleasurable. So there is the release of the endocannabinoids when you're together and you're cuddling that baby. And when the baby is threatened, the mother, the cortisol, big cortisol release, the mother defends the baby against against predators. So I think I never expected, actually, in my lifetime that we would make real progress in understanding sociality and, in particular, what we might call morality. But there is no doubt that we see it in all mammals. Mm-hmm. I mean, even rats, I mean, rats are actually pretty cool, but,
yeah.
you know, rats will food share with a non-sibling, a non-parent. They will lick and groom one that is hurting or in trouble. But of course, we know this too from dogs. I mean, you know, my dog is incredibly sensitive to my feelings. And that's because how she's wired. And she's wired a lot like how I'm wired. But, you know, it doesn't make me feel like I'm just a robot or I'm just a vacuum cleaner or something. I know that I'm a mammal with this amazing mammalian brain. I should have said that birds are included too, because actually there are more intensely social birds than there are, in terms of species, than there are intensely social mammals. Mm-hmm. And there's pretty good evolutionary reasons that we think account for that.
Right. Fun fact for listeners that don't know, I have a pet bird.
Oh, okay. What kind?
He's a zebra finch. Very not social with humans. He does not want me to touch him at all. But I have to cut his nails. So there's that. But yeah, so we can dive a little bit more into the focus for the month. Why do you think consciousness is special in comparison to ideas like memory, language, and decision making?
I don't think it's special. I think that Chalmers got on this hobby horse and he just rode it for all it's worth. And I think it's interesting, but it's certainly not more special than motor control. Mm. And it's noteworthy that a lot of motor control, once you've learned a skill, a lot of the execution of that skill is not particularly conscious. It happens way too fast. Mm-hmm. I watched Simone Biles doing the routine. Yeah, I know. And I watched it in super slow motion. And it's clear that she can't be making decisions consciously about what exactly to do every millisecond. It's not possible.
Right.
And but we know that from our own experience with various kinds of skills. I mean, here I am verbalizing away like anything. Am I making a conscious decision before every sentence, before every word choice? I don't think so. But it's kind of scary to think, here I am, you know, yakking away, and I'm not making a conscious decision about precisely what to say.
Yeah.
So yeah, consciousness is very nice and it's very fine. But to pick it out as unique amongst problems seems to me, you know, a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of processes will be quite slow if you have to keep making that conscious decision to, I mean, sometimes when I'm trying to have a conversation with someone, I find myself doing that and I have to apologize because I'm like, I'm so sorry. I sound like I'm constantly reevaluating the word that's coming next.
That's right. That's that. And I think we all have had that experience where if we try to consciously select the word of the thought before we hold forth, mm-hmm. that it makes us tongue-tied.
Right.
Can't do it. So yeah, I think consciousness is very interesting, and it's certainly one mystery amongst many others. I mean, one mystery really does pertain to the learning of very complex motor skills. Mm-hmm. Another one is how the hippocampus selects amongst the day's events that it remembers. How does it select those aspects to put into long-term memory? Mm. I mean, not, I will remember this event this morning. I'll remember it tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Every single aspect of what happened? I don't think so. I will remember the salient things. I will remember certain questions, probably not verbatim, but I'll remember the gist of them. How does that work?
Right.
We don't have the slightest idea.
That's why memory is very interesting to me personally.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
One thing that I've noticed is that the consciousness conversation seems to differ between disciplines. For example, in neurology or a neurological assessment, one might refer to states of awareness, such as being minimally conscious or being in a vegetative state. In philosophy, consciousness might refer to this subjective, qualitative experience one is having, aka qualia. So qualia is kind of describing what it's like to do something or be something. So I'm curious, does the consciousness conversation change when one is coming at it from a neurophilosophical perspective?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, my own preference is to be quite concrete about it. Mm-hmm. There is some research into consciousness that I find particularly revealing, and it has to do with trying to understand exactly the changes in the brain that occur when you're under an anesthetic such as propofol. And so Emory Brown, who is an anesthesiologist at Mass General, has these wonderful experiments on healthy controls where instead of, you know, like when I go in for surgery, you know, they give me a propofol and I'm gone. They titrate it very, very, very slowly. And they check on the level of consciousness by providing a stimulus, either a click or a word. Like the word might be manifold and the click would be just a click. And as long as the person is still pressing the button, there is some level of consciousness. And notice that it's levels of consciousness. It's not like it's, you know, all or nothing. Moreover, and I think one of the amazing findings actually was that subjects tended to lose consciousness for the click before they lost consciousness for the words. Hmm. So that was retained a little bit longer at a sort of deeper level of anesthesia. They could still respond to, yes, I'm aware of the word. In any case, then what Brown did was ask the question, so what are the changes that we see across the brain? How did he study that? Well, he put on large numbers of electrodes all over the brain. So he was doing EEG scanning. Mm-hmm. And basically what you see is that the spike rate drops. That is on the EEG, you see much less when you're awake. It looks like this. When you're under anesthesia, it looks like this. And you see an increase in the power of the waves, but a decrease in the frequency. So then Earl Miller's lab picked up on this, and they used non-human primates, monkeys, to actually put the electrodes in the brain itself. And to a first approximation, the result is that these changes in brain waves seem to reflect a kind of lack of coherence across a variety of brain structures. So that when you are awake and conscious, the thalamus, and in particular the central thalamus, as well as the locus coeruleus, as well as cortex, are all kind of playing to the same conductor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you're under anesthesia, it's like you've got a lot of little villages all over the place. So now that doesn't tell us everything we want to know about consciousness, but what it is an example of what David Chalmers thinks you can't ever get, and that's progress. And moreover, it's important progress, because when I go in for surgery, I don't want to say, well, look, you know, consciousness is not really understandable, so I think I'll just meditate and you guys go ahead and, you know, do what you have to do. Right. I'm not going to do that. I want the propofol and I want to know how it works. So those guys, you know, the panpsychists, for example, they don't have any practical approach to things like pain in surgery or depression. It's very interesting. Here's just another example of what I think is progress in understanding conscious experience, and that is that the drug ecstasy has been found to be surprisingly effective in dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And we know something about how ecstasy works and where it works and why it makes a difference. And I think that, you know, yeah, it's fun when you're in the bar to talk about everything, including electrons and cow pies having consciousness. But I actually value the very practical approaches where people try to discover something that will ease the pain of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's similar kinds of stuff to be told here about ketamine, which is, as I'm sure you know, also something that will affect the nature of conscious experience.
Yeah, we had an in-depth conversation on PTSD a couple episodes back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one thing I know you've probably gotten a lot of is maybe shock at the idea that a soul doesn't exist apart from the physical brain. I mean, one of your books is called Touching a Nerve, so you know that people may have a negative response. And I know from watching the interview with Stephen Colbert a couple years ago, he was also taken aback when when he said he probably didn't have a soul. However, it doesn't seem to worry you. I think you've almost described it as being peaceful to know that this is all there is. Could you maybe expand a little bit on that?
Yes, I think that it's important to sort of do the best you can with the life you've got, not to defer, you know, the things that need to be done to when you are all in heaven, and that's when you can make your apologies, or that's when you can reconnect to the people that you love. And I think it's okay that the life of living organisms is finite. We do the best we can with the finite time that we have. It always saddens me that dogs have a much shorter lifespan than humans. And I know most dog owners feel the same way. But there is something peace-inducing about living within the constraints as they exist. And by constraints, I mean, you know, the constraints are the limits that you can't really change. I mean, you can change a little bit with regard to lifespan. You know, you can exercise a lot and eat healthy food and so on and so forth. But you can't do very much. So live within the constraint and, you know, be happy with the good things that there are, and don't let the bad things get you down too often. And I mean, this sounds terribly boring. You know, I should be saying something really exotic and interesting, but I think these are kind of the facts of life.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, when you get down into looking at the biological processes and even just thinking about what you were talking about earlier, which is how does the hippocampus selectively pick memories to remember? It's like you can also revel in the fact that you are this combination of biological mechanisms. So that's another thing that I was thinking about.
I really like that. And I do sometimes revel in it when, you know, when I'm able to do something that I wasn't sure that I could do, I think, well, go brain. and isn't it amazing? So, I think that's a beautiful point. Yeah.
Yeah. We have to make the most of it. Back in when I was in high school or grade 9, there was a saying going around, all the kids were saying YOLO, you only live once, and one of my one of my teachers would get so mad when we would say that, because she was like, no, don't say that, I believe that there's a heaven and stuff, but it wasn't that serious, so it's okay. It was just a saying, but she'd get upset. So I guess you still, like, there's people that may be upset by these views, I guess, but it is what it is. As before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, based off all of this discussion, if you had to take a stab at defining consciousness, and I know you said there's different levels and everything, but how would you define it?
Well, I think it's premature to try to define it. It would be like trying to define the thing that transmits information from parent to offspring before the understanding of the nature of DNA. You know, we can't really do that. And we, you know, we can, if somebody genuinely wants to understand what we mean by consciousness, we can start by saying what it isn't. People in coma are not conscious. People in deep sleep are not conscious. People under anesthesia are not conscious. And then we can point to some of the things that you can experience, such as an itch or social touch, affective touch. You can give them examples, but I think it, at this stage, that's, it's okay that we can't give a precise definition. I mean, one of the things that is true about science is that definitions come very late in the development of science. I mean, think of the word element. Okay, so if you're living in the 4th century AD, elements are earth, air, fire, and water. Very easy definition, right? Yeah. Oh, dear. And so as chemistry proceeds, you realize that that definition was monumentally inadequate. And now we define elements in terms of the periodic table. And similarly for something like temperature, it's not caloric fluid, but you know, in the 17th century, probably that's how people would have been inclined to define it. So we can kind of, you know, point to the phenomena. I mean, fire is an interesting example because, let's say roughly in the 10th century AD, people did use examples that fire is the burning of wood, it's what happens on the sun, it's what happens in your gut when you eat something like a very hot pepper. They would give all these examples, except now we know that what happens on the sun is not what happens with burning wood. So it's an atomic event, whereas the burning of wood is a chemical event. Even early definitions that are cautious in the way I'm suggesting they should be cautious, and that is just use examples. Bear in mind that, you know, as time goes on, you might have to change the examples.
I think that's very commendable too, because especially since we have a lot of listeners that are students, they might be stuck on wanting a definition or wanting an answer, because throughout school you always learn like there must be an answer, you know, you need to know the answer. But it's great to hear a perspective where sometimes it's okay to not have an answer yet.
Yeah, and in the early stages of science, and we are sure in the early stages of neuroscience, there are many things that we cannot really define with great precision. Many functions of the brain, for example. We're not even sure we've got the right taxonomy for all kinds of stuff.
But it's exciting. It's exciting because
it is exciting, I think. And I mean, you guys are at a wonderful period of your lives when you can explore these things, and discoveries are just amazingly good fun. I mean, they can be important, yes, but it's all so fun.
Yes. I think I agree that it is premature to define consciousness, especially with the information that we know now. But there is a lot of exciting neuroscientific progress going on as to where that boundary is between consciousness and unconsciousness.
I'm hoping
we'll be able to get more into that later on in the month. Fingers crossed. But like I said earlier, we were so excited for this episode. So I want to thank you so much, Pat, for coming on.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's been a great pleasure.
Awesome. Okay. So this view is a really fascinating one, and I can imagine that some listeners may not fully agree. Nonetheless,
it's wonderful.
It's a perspective worth pondering about, right? If you agree or disagree or have some thoughts, let us know. Do you think there's more to the brain than what we can overtly see or what we've found so far? Let us know. I'll put links to what we reference in the bio, like Pat's book, Touching a Nerve, or the Colbert Show interview, and so on. And
the website, by the way, is there's a website, patriciachurchland.com. Yeah, and tons of stuff are there.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just ordered one of Pat's books, Brainwise. Yeah, so it arrived yesterday, so I can't wait to get into that.
Great.
And if you'd like to send comments about this episode, our email is thebraincorepodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram at thebraincorepodcast and on Twitter at thebraincorepod. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we always appreciate a rating or a comment. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you are having a great brain day.